Something bad could happen. There was a big thump nearby. I could see the lights shake. Then there was a noise like something tearing overhead. Everyone looked up and began to scream. The crack through the slanted ceiling hadn't looked particularly frightening, just a thin black line that zigzagged back and forth like a jigsaw snake, following the lines of the tiles. But then it widened suddenly, a gaping maw like a dragon's mouth, and dirt and tiles began to pour down. He had long since thawed, and yet every hair on his body rippled now with goose flesh. His heart pounded against the inside of his chest, and he felt as though the noose had drawn tight about his neck again.
"She let go,"
he said in a strangled whisper.
"She let go my hand."
Brianna's hand gripped his in both of hers, hard, trying to save the child he'd been. "She had to," she said in an urgent whisper. "Roger, she wouldn't have let go unless she had to."
"No."
He shook his head violently.
"That's not what I mean.
Wait a minute, okay?" He blinked hard, trying to slow his breathing, fitting back the shattered pieces of that night. Confusion, frenzy, pain. But what had actually happened? He had kept nothing save an impression of bedlam. But he'd lived through it. He must know what had happened, if he could bring himself to live through it again. Brianna's hand clutched his, her fingers still squeezing tight enough to stop the blood. He patted her hand gently, and her grip relaxed a little. He closed his eyes and let it happen.
"I didn't remember at first," he said at last, quietly. "Or rather, I did. But I remembered what people told me had happened."
He had had no memory of being carried unconscious through the tunnel, and once rescued, he had spent several weeks being shuttled round aid shelters and foster homes with other orphans, mute with terrified bewilderment.
"I knew my name, of course, and my address, but that didn't help much under the circumstances. My dad had already gone down. Anyway, by the time the aid people located Gran's brother, that was the Reverend, and he came to fetch me, they'd pieced together the story of what happened in the shelter. It was a miracle that I hadn't been killed with everyone else on that stair, they told me. They said my mother must somehow have lost hold of me in the panic. I must have been separated from her and carried down the stair by the crowd. That's how I ended on the lower level where the roof hadn't given way."
Brianna's hand was still curled over his, protective, but no longer squeezing.
"But now you remember what happened?" she asked quietly. "I did remember her letting go my hand," he said. "And so I thought the rest of it was right too. But it wasn't." "She let go my hand," he said.
The words came more easily now. The tightness in his throat and chest was gone.
"She let go my hand. And then she picked me up. That small woman. She picked me up and threw me over the wall, down into the crowd of people on the platform below. I was knocked mostly out by the fall, I think. But I remember the roar as the roof went. No one on the stair survived."
She pressed her face against his chest, and he felt her take a deep, shuddering breath. He stroked her hair, and his pounding heart began to slow at last.
"It's all right," he whispered to her, though his voice was thick and cracked, and the firelight burst in starry blurs through the moisture in his eyes. "We won't forget. Not Jim. Not me. No matter what, we won't forget."
He could see his mother's face, shining clear among the stars.
"Clever lad," she said,
and smiled. Chapter 99. Brother. The snow began to melt. I was torn between pleasure at the thawing of the world and the throb of spring in the ground, and disturbance at the loss of the frozen barrier that shielded us, however temporarily, from the world outside. Jamie hadn't changed his mind. He spent an evening in composing a carefully worded letter to Milford Lyon. He was now ready, he wrote, to contemplate the sale of his goods, for which, read illegal whiskey, as Mr. Lyon had suggested, and was pleased to say that a substantial quantity was now available. He was, however, concerned lest his goods suffer some misfortune in delivery, i.e. interception by customs authorities or pilferage en route, and wished some assurance that his goods would be handled by a gentleman of known ability in such matters. In other words, a smuggler who knew his way up and down the coast. He had received assurances from his good friend Mr. Priestley of Edenton, whom he did not, of course, know from a hole in the ground, he wrote, and from Mr. Samuel Cornell, with whom he had had the honour to serve upon the Governor's Council of War, that one Stephen Bonnet was by far the most able in such endeavours, with a reputation for ability unsurpassed by others. If Mr. Lyon would arrange a meeting with Mr. Bonnet, so that Jamie might form his own impressions, and assure himself of the safety of the arrangement contemplated, why then...
"Do you think he'll do it?" I asked.
"If he knew Stephen Bonnet, or can find him, aye, he will." Jamie pressed his father's cabochon ring into the wax seal. "Priestley and Cornell are names to conjure with, to be sure."
"And if he does find Bonnet?"
"Then I will go and meet with him."
He cracked the ring from the hardened wax, leaving a smooth indentation surrounded by the tiny strawberry leaves of the Fraser crest. Constancy they stood for. In some moods I was sure this was merely another word for stubbornness.
The letter to Lyon was dispatched with Fergus, and I tried to dismiss it from my mind. It was still winter. With only a little luck, Bonnet's ship might meet with a storm and sink, saving us all a good deal of trouble. Still, the matter lurked in the recesses of my mind, and when I returned to the house after attending a childbirth to find a pile of letters on the desk in Jamie's study, my heart leapt into my throat. There was, thank God, no answer among them from Milford Lyon. Even had such an answer come, though, it would have been promptly eclipsed and forgotten, for among the sheaf of correspondence was a letter bearing Jamie's name, written in his sister's strong black hand. I could scarcely keep myself from tearing it open at once, and if it were some searing reproach, sticking it directly into the fire before Jamie could see it. Honour prevailed, though, and I managed to contain myself until Jamie arrived from an errand to Salem, plastered with mud from the impassable trails. Informed of the waiting missive, he splashed hands and face hastily with water and came to the study, carefully shutting the door before breaking the seal of the letter. His face showed nothing, but I saw him take a deep breath before opening it, as though bracing for the worst. I moved quietly round behind him and put a hand on his shoulder in encouragement. Jenny Fraser Murray wrote in a well-schooled hand, the letters round and graceful, the lines straight and easily readable on the page. September 16th, 1771. Brother. Well. Having taken up my pen and written the single word above, I've now sat here staring at it till the candle has burned almost an inch, and me having not one thought what I shall say. It would be a wicked waste of good beeswax to continue so, and yet, if I were to put the candle out and go to bed, I should have spoiled a sheet of paper to no purpose. So I see I must go on, in the name of thrift. I could berate you, that would occupy some space upon the page, and preserve what my husband is pleased to compliment as the most foul and hideous curses he has been privileged to hear in a long life. That seems thrifty, as I was at great pains in the composition of them at the time, and should not like to see the effort wasted. Still, I think I have not so much paper as would contain them all. I think also that perhaps, after all, I do not wish to rail or condemn you, for you might take this as a just punishment, and so ease your conscience in perceived expiation, so that you leave off your chastising of yourself. That is too simple a penance. I would that if you have wove a hair shirt for yourself, you wear it still, and may it chafe your soul as the loss of my son chafes mine. In spite of this, I suppose that I am writing to forgive you. I had some purpose in taking up my pen, I know, and while forgiveness seems a doubtful enterprise to me at present, I expect the notion will grow more comfortable with practice. Jamie's brows rose nearly to his hairline at this, but he continued to read aloud with fascination. You will be curious to know what has led me to this action, I suppose. So I will tell you. I wrote to visit Maggie early Monday last. She has a new babe, so you are once more an uncle. A bonny wee lass called Angelica, which is a foolish name, I think, but she's very fair, and born with a strawberry mark on her chest, which is a charm for good. I left them in the evening, and had made some way towards home, when my mule chanced to step into a mole's hole and fell. Both mule and I rose up somewhat lamed from this accident, and it was clear that I could not ride the creature, nor yet make shift to travel far by foot myself. I found myself on the road all day, just over the hill from Balrigan. I should not normally seek the society of Lyra Mackenzie, for she has resumed that name. I, having made plain in the district my dislike of her use of Fraser, she having no proper claim to that style. But it was the only place where I might obtain food and shelter, for night was coming on with the threat of rain. So I unsaddled the mule and left him to find his supper by the road while I limped off in search of mine. I came down behind the house, past the kale yard, and so came upon the arbour that you built. The vines are well grown on it now, so I could see nothing, but I could hear that there were folk inside, for I heard voices. The rain had begun by then. It was naught but a mizzle, yet the patter on the leaves must have drowned my voice, for no one answered when I called. I came closer, creeping like a spavin snail, to be sure, for I was gromish from the fall and my right ankle gruppet, and was just about to call once more, when I heard the sounds of a rare hochmagandy from inside the arbour. Hochmagandy? I glanced at Jamie, brows raised in question.
Fornication, he said tersely.
Oh, I said, and moved to look over his shoulder at the letter. I stood still, of course, thinking what was best to do. I could hear that it was Lyra shedding her shanks, but I had no hint who her partner might be. My ankle was blown up like a bladder, so I couldn't walk much further, and so I was obliged to stand about in the wet, listening to all this inhonesty. I should have known had she been courted by a man of the district, and I had heard nothing of her paying heed to any, though several have tried. She has Balrigan, after all, and lives like a laird on the money you pay her. I was filled with outrage at the hearing, but somewhat more filled with amazement to discover the cause. That, being a sense of fury on your behalf, irrational as such fury might be in the circumstances. Still, having discovered such an emotion springing full-blown in my breast, I was reluctantly compelled to the realization that my feelings for you must not, in fact, have perished altogether. Here the text broke off, as Jenny had apparently been called away upon some domestic errand. It resumed, freshly dated, on the next page. September 18, 1771. I dream of young Ian now and then.
What? I exclaimed. To hell with young Ian! Who was with Lyra?
I should like to know that myself, Jamie muttered. The tips of his ears were dark with blood, but he didn't look up from the page.
I dream of Ian now and then. These dreams most often take the shape of daily life, and I see him here at Lallybroch. But now and again I dream of him and his life among the savages, if indeed he still lives, and I persuade myself that my heart would by some means know if he did know it. So I see that what it comes to in the end is only the same thing with which I began, that one word, brother. You are my brother, as young Ian is my son, the both of you, my flesh and my spirit, and always shall be. If the loss of Ian haunts my dreams, the loss of you haunts my days, Jamie.
He stopped reading for a moment, swallowing, then went on, his voice steady.
This ends Disc 41. The Fiery Cross, Disc 42.
I've been writing letters all morning, debating with myself whether to finish this one or to put it into the fire instead. But now the accounts are done, I've written to everyone I can think of, and the clouds have gone away, so the sun shines through the window by my desk, and the shadows of mother's roses are falling over me. I thought to myself often and often that I heard my mother speak to me through all these years. I do not need to hear her now, though, to ken well enough what she would say. And so I shall not put this in the fire. You remember, do you, the day I broke the good cream pitcher, flinging it at your head because you devilled me? I know you recall the occasion, for you once spoke to Claire of it. I hesitated to admit the crime, and you took the blame upon yourself. But Father kent the truth of it, and punished us both. So now I am a grandmother 10 times over, with my hair gone grey, and still I feel my cheeks go hot with shame, and my wames shrink like a fist, thinking of Father bidding us kneel down side by side, and bend over the bench to be whipped. You yelped and grunted like a puppy when he tossed you, and I could scarce breathe and didn't dare look at you. Then it was my turn, but I was so wrought with emotion that I think I barely felt the strokes. No doubt you were reading this and saying indignantly that it was only Father was softer with me because I was a lass. Well, maybe so, and maybe no. I will say Ian is gentle with his daughters. Jamie snorted at this. "Ah, you got that right," he muttered. He rubbed his nose with one finger and resumed, drumming his fingers on the desk as he read. "But then Father said you would have another whipping, this one for lying, for the truth was the truth after all. I would have got up and fled away then, but he bade me stay as I was, and he said to me, quiet, that while you would pay the price of my cowardice, he didn't think it right for me to escape it altogether. Do you know that you did not make a sound the second time? I hope you did not feel the strokes of the tawse on your backside, because I felt each one. I swore that day that I should not ever be a coward again. And I see that it is cowardice indeed that I should go on blaming you for young Ian. I've always kent what it is to love a man, be he husband or brother, lover or son. A dangerous business, that's what it is. Men will go where they will. They do as they must. It is not a woman's part to bid them stay, nor yet to reproach them for being what they are, or for not coming back. I knew when I sent Ian to France with a cross of birch wood and a lock of my hair made into a love knot, praying that he might come home to me, body and soul. I knew it when I gave you a rosary and saw you off to Leach, hoping you wouldn't forget Lallybroch or me. I knew it when young Jamie swam to the Seal's Island, when Michael took ship for Paris. And I should have known it too, when wee Ian went with you. But I've been blessed in my life. My men have always come back to me. Maimed, perhaps, a bit singed round the edges now and then. Crippled, crumpled, tattered and torn. But I've always got them back. I grew to expect that as my right, and I was wrong to do so. I've seen so many widows since the rising. I cannot say why I thought I should be exempt from their suffering, why I alone should lose none of my men, and only one of my babes, my wee girl child. And since I had lost Caitlin, I treasured Ian, for I knew he was the last babe I should bear. I thought him my babe still. I should have kent him for the man he was. And that being so, I know well enough that whether you might have stopped him or no, you would not, for you are one of the damnable creatures too. Now I've nearly reached the end of this sheet, and I think it profligate to begin another. Mother loved you always, Jamie. When she kent she was dying, she called for me and bade me care for you. As though I could ever stop. Your most affectionate and loving sister,
Janet, Flora, Arabella, Fraser, Murray. Jamie held the paper for a moment, then set it down very gently. He sat with his head bent, propped on his hand so that I couldn't see his face. His fingers were splayed through his hair and kept moving, massaging his forehead as he slowly shook his head back and forth. I could hear him breathing with a slight catch in his breath now and then. Finally, he dropped his hand and looked up at me, blinking. His face was deeply flushed. There were tears in his eyes, and he wore the most remarkable expression in which bewilderment, fury, and laughter were all mingled, laughter being only slightly uppermost.
"Oh, God," he said.
He sniffed and wiped his eyes on the back of his hand.
"Oh, Christ, how in hell does she do that?"
"Do what?" I pulled a clean handkerchief from my bodice and handed it to him.
"Make me feel as though I'm 8 years old," he said ruefully, "and an idiot to boot."
He wiped his nose, then reached out a hand to touch the flattened roses, gently. I was thrilled with Jenny's letter and knew that Jamie's heart was substantially lightened by its receipt. At the same time, I remained extremely curious about the incident she'd begun to describe. I knew that Jamie was even more interested, though he carefully refrained from saying so. A letter arrived a week or so later, sent by his brother-in-law, Ian, but while this contained the usual news of Lallybroch and Broch Morda, it made no mention whatever of Jenny's adventure near Balriggan, nor her subsequent discovery in the grape arbour. "I don't suppose you could ask either of them," I suggested delicately, perched on the fence as I watched him preparing to castrate a litter of piglets. "Ian or Jenny?"
"I could not," Jamie replied firmly. "And after all, it's no my business, is it? If yon woman was ever my wife, she surely is not now. If she chooses to take a lover, it's her own affair, surely."
He stamped on the foot bellows, fanning up the small fire in which the quartery iron was heating, and pulled the castrating shears from his belt.
"Which end of the business do you want, Sassenach?"
It was a choice between the strong possibility of being bitten while clipping the teeth and the certainty of being shitten while assaulting the other end. The unfortunate truth was that Jamie was far stronger than I, and while he could certainly castrate an animal with no difficulty at all, I did have some professional expertise. It was therefore practicality rather than heroism that dictated my choice, and I had prepared for this activity by donning my heavy canvas apron, wooden clogs, and a ragged ex-shirt that had once belonged to Fergus, and was bound from the pig pen straight into the fire. "You hold, I'll snip." I slid off the fence and took the shears. There ensued a brief but noisy interlude, after which the five piglets were sent off to a consolatory meal of kitchen scraps, their rear aspects heavily daubed with a tar and turpentine mixture to prevent infection. "What do you think?" I asked, seeing them settle down to their feeding in an apparent state of content. "If you were a pig, I mean. Would you rather root for your food but keep your balls, or give them up and wallow in luxurious swill?" These would be kept penned, raised carefully on slops for tender meat, while most of the pigs were routinely turned out into the woods to manage for themselves. Jamie shook his head.
"I suppose they canna miss what they've never had," he said. "And they've had food, after all."
He leaned on the fence for a few moments, watching the curly tails begin to wag and twirl with pleasure, the tiny wounds beneath apparently forgotten.
"Besides," he added cynically, "a pair of bollocks may bring a man more sorrow than joy, though I haven't met many who'd wish them gone for all that."
"Well, priests might find them a burden, I suppose." I pulled the stained shirt gingerly away from my body before lifting it over my head. "Phew! Nothing smells worse than pig excrement. Nothing!"
"What? Not a blackbirder's hold or a rotting corpse?" he asked, laughing. "Festering wounds? A billy goat?"
"Pig shit," I said firmly. "Hands down." Jamie took the wadded shirt from me and ripped it into strips, reserving the cleanest ones for jobs like wiping tools and wedging cracks. The rest he consigned to the fire, stepping back as a random breeze blew a plume of reeking smoke in our direction.
Well, there was Narses. He was a great general, or so they say, in spite of being a eunuch.
Perhaps a man's mind works better without the distraction, I suggested, laughing. He gave no more than a brief snort in reply to this, though it was tinged with amusement. He shovelled dirt onto the cinders of the fire while I retrieved my quartery iron and tar pot, and we went back to the house, talking of other things. My mind lingered on that one remark, though.
A pair of bollocks may bring a man more sorrow than joy.
Had he been speaking only generally, I wondered, or had there been some personal allusion lurking in it? In everything he had ever said to me regarding his brief marriage to Lyra Mackenzie, little as that was by our common consent, there had been no hint that he had felt physically drawn to her. He had wed her from loneliness and a sense of duty, wanting some small anchor in the emptiness his life had been after his return from England. Or so he had said. And I believed what he'd said. He was a man of honour and duty, and I knew what his loneliness had been, for I had had my own. On the other hand, I knew his body nearly as well as my own. If it had a great capacity to endure hardship, it had an equal capacity to experience great joy. Jamie could be ascetic from necessity, never from natural temperament. Most of the time I succeeded in forgetting that he had shared Lyra's bed, however briefly, and he said, unsatisfactorily. I did not forget that she had been, and was still, quite an attractive woman. Which left me rather wishing that Jenny Murray had found some other inspiration for the conversion of her feelings toward her brother. Jamie was quiet and abstracted through the rest of the day, though he roused himself to be sociable when Fergus and Massali arrived with their children for a visit after supper. He taught Germaine to play draughts, while Fergus recalled for Roger the words of a ballad he had picked up in the alleys of Paris as a juvenile pickpocket. The women retired to the hearth to stitch baby gowns, knit booties and, in honour of Massali's advancing pregnancy and Lizzie's engagement, entertain each other with hair-raising anecdotes of labour and birth.
Laid sideways the babe was, and the size of a six-month shoot. Huh? Germaine had a head like a cannonball, the midwife said, and he was facing back, what the wee rattan.
Jimmy had a huge head, but it was his shoulders that were the problem. Le bourse, the lady's purse, of course, is her means of making a living. Aye, I see. Then the next bit, where a customer puts his fingers in her purse. No, you dinna get to move yet. It's still my turn, for I've jumped your man there, and so I can go here.
Merde! Germaine!
Massali bellowed. She glared at her offspring, who hunched his shoulders, scowling at the draught board, lower lip thrust out.
Then fash yourself, man, for see, now it's your turn. Ye can go there, and there, and there. Avez-vous êtes à la selle aujourd'hui? And what he is asking the hall, of course. Have you been in the saddle today? Or would it be, have you had a ride today?
Fergus laughed, the end of his aristocratic nose pinkening with amusement.
Well, that is one translation, surely.
Roger lifted a brow at him, half smiling.
Aye.
That particular expression is also what a French doctor says, I put in, seeing his incomprehension. Colloquially speaking, it means, have you had a bowel movement today?
The lady in question, being perhaps une spécialiste,
Fergus explained cheerfully.
I used to know one who...
Fergus! Massali's whole face was pink, though she seemed more amused than outraged.
I see,
Roger murmured, eyebrows still raised as he struggled with the nuances of this bit of sophisticated translation. I did wonder how one would set it to music.
Comment sont vos ailes, grand-père?
Germaine inquired chummily, evidently familiar with this line of social inquiry. And how are your stools, grandfather?
Free and easy, his grandfather assured him. Eat up your porridge every morning and you'll never have piles.
Da!
Well, it's true, Jamie protested.
Brianna was bright red and emitting small fizzing noises.
Jemmy stirred in her lap.
Le petit rouge eats porridge,
Germaine observed, frowning narrowly at Jemmy, who was nursing contentedly at his mother's breast, eyes closed.
He shits stones.
Germaine!
All the women shouted in unison.
Well, it's true,
he said, in perfect imitation of his grandfather. Looking dignified, he turned his back on the women and began building towers with the draughtsmen.
He doesn't seem to want to give up the teat, Massali observed, nodding at Jemmy.
Neither did Germaine, but he'd no choice.
Nor did poor wee Junie.
She glanced ruefully down at her stomach, which was barely beginning to swell with number three. I caught the barest flicker of a glance between Roger and Bree, followed by a Mona Lisa smile on Brianna's face. She settled herself more comfortably and stroked Jemmy's head.
Enjoy it while you can, sweetheart, her actions said, more vividly than words.
I felt my own eyebrows rise and glanced toward Jamie. He'd seen that little byplay, too, and gave me the male equivalent of Brianna's smile before turning back to the draughts board.
I like porridge,
Lizzie put in shyly, in a minor attempt to change the subject,
especially with honey and milk.
Ah,
said Fergus, reminded of his original task. He turned back to Roger, lifting a finger.
Honey pots, the refrain, you see, where les abeilles come buzzing.
Aye, aye, that's so,
Mrs. Bug neatly recaptured the conversation when he paused to draw breath.
Porridge with honey is the best thing for the bowels, though sometimes even that fails. Why, I kent a man once who couldn't move his bowels for more than a month.
Indeed? Did he try a pellet of wax rolled in goose grease? Or a tisane of grape leaves?
Fergus was instantly diverted. French to the core, he was a great connoisseur of purges, laxatives, and suppositories.
Everything,
Mrs. Bug assured him.
Porridge, dried apples, wine mixed with an ox's gall, water drunk at the dark of the moon at midnight. Nothing at all would shift him. 'Twas the talk of the village, wi' folk placing wagers and the poor man gone quite grey in the face. Nervous spasms it was, and his bowels tied up like garter strings so that...
Did he explode? Germaine asked, interested. Mrs. Bug shook briefly with laughter.
No, that he didn't, laddie. Though I did hear as how it was a near thing.
What was it finally shifted him, then? Jamie asked.
She finally said she'd marry me and not the other fellow.
Mr. Bug, who had been dozing in the corner of the settle through the evening, stood up and stretched himself, then put a hand on his wife's shoulder, smiling tenderly down at her upturned face. 'Twas a great relief, to be sure. It was late when we went to bed, after a convivial evening that ended with Fergus singing the prostitute's ballad in its lengthy entirety to general applause, Jamie and Germaine beating time on the table with their hands. Jamie lay back against the pillow, hands crossed behind his head, chuckling to himself now and then as bits of the song came back to him. It was cold enough that the window panes were misted with our breath, but he wore no nightshirt, and I admired the sight of him as I sat brushing my hair. He had recovered well from the snake bite, but was still thinner than usual, so that the graceful arch of his collarbone was visible, and the long muscles of his arms, roped from bone to bone, distinct beneath his skin. The skin of his chest was bronze where his shirt usually lay open, but the tender skin on the underside of his arms was white as milk, a tracery of blue veins showing. The light shadowed the prominent bones of his face and glimmered from his hair, cinnamon and amber where it lay across his shoulders, dark auburn and red gold where it dusted his bared body.
The candlelight becomes you, Sassenach,
he said, smiling, and I saw that he was watching me, blue eyes the colour of bottomless ocean.
I was just thinking the same of you, I said, standing up and putting aside my brush.
My hair floated in a cloud round my shoulders, clean, soft, and shining. It smelled of marigolds and sunflowers, and so did my skin. Bathing and shampooing in winter was a major undertaking, but I had been determined not to go to bed smelling of pig shit.
"Let it burn, then," he said,
reaching out to stop me as I bent to blow the candle out. His hand curled round my wrist, urging me toward him.
Come to bed and let me watch you. I like the way the light moves in your eyes. Like whiskey when you pour it on a haggis and then set it on fire.
How poetic, I murmured, but made no demur as he made room for me, pulled loose the drawstring of my shift, and slipped it off me. The air of the room was cold enough to make my nipples draw up tight, but the skin of his chest was delightfully warm on my breasts as he gathered me into him, sighing with pleasure.
"It's Fergus's song inspiring me, I expect," he said,
cupping one of my breasts in his hand and weighing it with a nice balance between admiration and appraisal.
"God, you've the loveliest breasts. You recall that one verse where he says the lady's tits were so enormous she could wrap them round his ears? Yours aren't so big as that, of course. But you think you maybe could wrap them round..."
"I don't think they need to be enormous to do that," I assured him. "Move up. Besides, I don't believe it's actually wrapping round so much as it's squashing together. And they're certainly large enough for... See?"
"Oh," he said,
sounding deeply gratified and a little breathless.
"Ah, you're right. That's... Oh, that looks very beautiful, Sassenach. At least from here."
"It looks very interesting from here, too," I assured him, trying neither to laugh nor go cross-eyed. "Which one of us moves, do you think?"
"Me, for now. I'm no chafing you, Sassenach," he inquired.
"Well, just a bit. Wait, though." I reached out a hand, feeling blindly over the table by the bed. I got hold of the little pot of creamy almond ointment I used for hand lotion, flicked the lid off, and dug a finger into it.
"Yes, that's much better," I said. "Isn't it?" "Oh, oh, aye. And then there's that other verse, isn't there?" I said thoughtfully, letting go for a moment and drawing a slippery finger slowly round the curve of his buttock. "About what the prostitute did to the choir boy."
"Oh, Christ!"
"Yes, that's what he said, according to the song." Much later in the dark, I roused from sleep to feel his hands on me again. Still pleasantly adrift in dreams, I didn't move, but lay inert, letting him do what he would. My mind was loosely tethered to reality, and it took some time for me to come to the slow realization that something wasn't quite right. It took even longer to focus my mind and struggle toward the surface of wakefulness, but at last I got my eyes open, blinking away clouds of sleep. He was crouched half over me, his face half lit by the dim glow from the smoured hearth. His eyes were closed, and he was frowning a little, his breath coming through half-opened lips. He moved almost mechanically, and I wondered, muzzily astonished, whether he could possibly be doing it in his sleep. A thin film of sweat gleamed on the high cheekbones, the long straight bridge of his nose, on the slopes and curves of his naked body. He was stroking me in an odd, monotonous sort of way, like a man working at some repetitive task. The touch was more than intimate, but weirdly impersonal. I might have been anybody. Or anything, I thought. Then he moved, and eyes still closed, flipped back the quilt covering me and moved between my legs, spreading them apart in a brusque fashion that was quite unlike him. His brows were drawn together, knotted in a frown of concentration. I moved instinctively to close my legs, squirming away. His hands clamped down on my shoulders then, his knee thrust my thighs apart, and he entered me roughly. I made a high-pitched sound of startled protest, and his eyes popped open. He stared at me, his eyes no more than an inch from mine, unfocused, then sharpening into abrupt awareness. He froze. "Who the bloody hell do you think I am?" I said, low-voiced and furious. He wrenched himself away and flung himself off the bed, leaving the covers hanging to the floor in disarray. He seized his clothes from the peg, reached the door in two strides, opened it, and disappeared, slamming it behind him. I sat up, feeling thoroughly rattled. I scrabbled the quilts back up around myself, feeling dazed, angry, and halfway disbelieving. I rubbed my hands over my face, trying to wake up all the way. Surely I hadn't been dreaming. No, he was. He'd been half asleep, or wholly so, and he'd bloody thought I was bloody Lyra. Nothing else could account for the way he'd been touching me, with a sense of painful impatience tinged with anger. He had never touched me like that in his life. I lay back down, but it was patently impossible to go back to sleep. I stared at the shadowy rafters for a few minutes, then rose with decision and got dressed. The dooryard was bleak and cold under a high, bright moon. I stepped out, closing the kitchen door softly behind me, and clutched my cloak round me, listening. Nothing stirred in the cold, and the wind was no more than a sigh through the pines. At some distance, though, I heard a faint, regular noise, and turned toward it, making my way carefully through the dark. The door of the hay barn was open. I leaned against the door jamb and crossed my arms, watching as he stamped to and fro, pitching hay in the moonlight, working off his temper. Mine was still pulsing in my temples, but began to subside as I watched him. The difficulty was that I did understand, and all too well. I hadn't met many of Frank's women. He was discreet. But now and then I would catch a glance exchanged at a faculty party or the local supermarket, and a feeling of black rage would well up in me, only to be followed by bafflement as to what precisely I was to do with it. Jealousy had nothing to do with logic. Lyra Mackenzie was 6,000 miles away. Likely neither of us would ever see her again. Frank was even farther away, and it was certain neither of us would ever see him again, this side the grave. No, jealousy had nothing at all to do with logic. I began to be cold, but went on standing there. He knew I was there. I could see it in the way he kept his head turned toward his work. He was sweating, in spite of the cold. The thin cloth of his shirt stuck to him, making a dark spot on his back. At last, he stabbed the pitchfork into the stack, left it, and sat down on a bench made from half a log. He put his head in his hands, fingers rubbing violently through his hair. Finally, he looked up at me, with an expression halfway between dismay and reluctant amusement.
I dinna understand it.
What? I moved toward him and sat down near him, curling my feet under me. I could smell the sweat on his skin, along with almond cream and the ghost of his earlier lust. He gave me a sidelong glance and answered dryly,
"Anything, Sassenach."
"Can't be that bad, can it?" I reached tentatively for him and ran a hand lightly down the curve of his back. He heaved a deep sigh, blowing air through pursed lips.
"When I was 23, I did not understand how it was that to look at a woman could turn my bones to water, yet make me feel I could bend steel in my hands. When I was 25, I did not understand how I could want both to cherish a woman and ravish her all at once.
A woman?" I asked, and got what I wanted, the curl of his mouth and a glance that went through my heart.
"One woman," he said.
He took the hand I laid on his knee and held it tightly as though afraid I might snatch it back.
"Just one,"
he repeated, his voice husky. It was quiet in the barn, but the boards creaked and settled in the cold. I moved a little on the bench, scooting toward him. Just a little. Moonlight streamed through the wide open door, glowing dimly off the piled hay.
"And that," he said, squeezing my fingers tighter, "is what I dinna ken now. I love you, Aneen Down. I've loved you from the moment I saw you. I will love you till time itself is done, and so long as you are by my side, I am well pleased with the world.
A flush of warmth went through me, but before I could do more than squeeze his hand in reply, he went on, turning to look at me with an expression of bewilderment so desperate as to be almost comical.
And that being so clear, why, in the name of Christ and all his saints, why do I want to take ship to Scotland, hunt down a man whose name and face I dinna ken at all, and kill him for swiving a woman to whom I have nae claim, and who I couldna stand to be in the same room with for more than 3 minutes at the most?
He brought his free hand down in a fist, striking the log with a thump that vibrated through the wood under my buttocks.
I do not understand.
I suppressed the urge to say, and you think I do? Instead, I merely sat quietly, and after a moment, stroked his knuckles very lightly with my thumb. It was less a caress than a simple reassurance, and he took it so. After a moment, he sighed deeply, squeezed my hand, and stood up.
I'm a fool, he said.
I sat still for a moment, but he seemed to expect some sort of confirmation, so I nodded obligingly. Well, perhaps, I said. But you aren't going to Scotland, are you? Instead of replying, he got to his feet and walked moodily to and fro, kicking clumps of dried mud, which burst like small bombs.
Surely he wasn't contemplating... He couldn't be.
With some difficulty, I kept my mouth shut and waited patiently until he came back to stand in front of me.
All right, he said,
in the tone of one stating a declaration of principle.
I dinna ken why it galls me that Lyra should seek another man's company. No. That's no the truth, is it? I ken well enough. And it isna jealousy. Or... Well, it is then, but that's no the main thing.
He shot me a look as though daring me to contradict this assertion, but I kept my mouth shut. He exhaled strongly through his nose and took a deep breath, looking down.
Well then, if I'm honest about it...
His lips pressed tight together for a moment.
Why?
He burst out, looking up at me.
What is it about him?
What is what about who? The man she...
She hated it. The bedding.
He interrupted me, stamping a clod into powder.
Perhaps I flatter myself, or you flatter me.
He gave me a look that wanted to be a glare, but ended in bewilderment.
Am I? Am I?
I wasn't sure whether he wanted me to say, yes, you are, or no, you're not, but satisfied myself with a smile that said both.
I will, he said reluctantly. I didn't think it was me. And before we were wed, even Lyra liked me well enough.
I must have made a small snort at that, for he glanced at me, but I shook my head, dismissing it.
I thought it must be a mislike for men in general, or only for the act. And if it was so, well, it wasn't quite so bad if it wasn't my fault. Though I did feel somehow I should be able to mend it.
He trailed off into his thoughts, brow furrowed, then resumed with a sigh.
But maybe I was wrong about that. Perhaps it was me. And that's a thought that sticks in my craw.
I had no real idea what to say to him, but clearly I had to say something. I think it was her, I said firmly, not you. Though, of course, I may be prejudiced. She did try to kill me, after all.
She what?
He swung round, looking blank. You didn't know that? Oh. I tried to think. Had I not told him?
No, I suppose not. What with one thing and another, it hadn't seemed important at the time. I'd never expected to see her again.
And later... Well, it really wasn't important then. I explained briefly about Lyra's having sent me to join Geely Duncan that day in Crane's Muir, fully aware that Geely was about to be arrested for witchcraft, and hoping that I would be taken with her, as indeed I was.
The wicked wee bitch, he said, sounding more astonished than anything else. "No, I didn't ken that at all. Christ, Sassenach, you canna think I would have married the woman knowing she'd done such a thing to you?"
"Well, she was only 16 at the time," I said, able, under the circumstances, to be tolerantly forgiving. "And she might not have realised that we'd be tried, or that the witch court would try to burn us. She might only have meant mischief, thinking that if I were accused as a witch, it would make you lose interest in me." The revelation of her chicanery seemed at least to have distracted Jamie's mind, which was all to the good. His only response to this was a snort. He paced restlessly to and fro for a bit, his feet rustling in the spilled straw. He hadn't taken his shoes or stockings, and was barefoot, though the cold seemed not to trouble him. At last he stopped, heaved a massive sigh, and bent forward, resting a hand on the bench, his head on my shoulder.
"I'm sorry," he whispered.
I put my arms round his shoulders and pulled him close, holding him hard until at last he sighed again and the knotted strain in his shoulders relaxed. I let go, and he stood up, giving me a hand to rise. We closed the barn door and walked back to the house in silence, hand in hand.
"Claire," he said suddenly, sounding a little shy.
"Yes?"
"I didna mean to excuse myself. Not at all. It's only I was wondering, do you ever think of Frank when we..."
He stopped and cleared his throat.
"Does the shadow of the Englishman perhaps cross my face now and then?"
And what on earth could I say to that? I couldn't lie, surely. But how could I say the truth, either, in a way he would understand, that wouldn't hurt him? I drew a deep breath and let it out, watching the mist of it purl softly away. "I don't want to make love to a ghost," I said at last, firmly. "And I don't think you do, either. But I suppose, every now and then, a ghost might have other ideas."
He made a small sound that was mostly a laugh.
"Aye," he said, "I suppose they might. I wonder if Lyra would like the Englishman's bed better than mine."
"Serve her right if she did," I said. "But if you like mine, I suggest you come and get back into it. It's bloody cold out here."
Chapter 100. Dead Whale. By late March, the trails down the mountain were passable. No word had come yet from Milford Lion, and after some debate on the matter, it was decided that Jamie and I, with Brianna, Roger and Masali, would travel to Wilmington, while Fergus took the survey reports to New Bern to be formally filed and registered. The girls and I would buy supplies, depleted over the winter, such as salt, sugar, coffee, tea and opium, while Roger and Jamie would make discreet inquiries after Milford Lion and Stephen Bonnet. Fergus would come to join us so soon as the surveying reports were taken care of, making his own inquiries along the coast as chance offered. After which, presumably, Jamie and Roger, having located Mr. Bonnet, would drop round to his place of business and take turns either shooting him dead or running him through with a sword before riding back into the mountains, congratulating themselves on a job well done. Or so I understood the plan to be. "The best laid plans of mice and men gang aft agley," I quoted to Jamie, in the midst of one discussion on the matter. He raised one brow and gave me a look.
"What sort of plans have mice got?"
"Well, there you have me," I admitted. "The principle holds, though. You haven't any idea what may happen."
"That's true," he agreed. "But whatever does happen, I shall be ready for it."
He patted the dirk that lay on the corner of his desk and went back to making lists of farm supplies. The weather warmed markedly as we descended from the mountains, and as we drew nearer to the coast, flocks of seagulls and crows wheeled and swarmed over the fresh ploughed fields, shrieking ecstatically in the bright spring sunshine. The trees in the mountains were barely beginning to leaf out, but in Wilmington, flowers were already glowing in the gardens, spikes of yellow columbine and blue larkspur nodding over the tidy fences on Beaufort Street. We found lodgings in a small, clean inn a little way from the quay. It was relatively cheap and reasonably comfortable, if a trifle crowded and dark. "Why don't they have more windows?" Brianna grumbled, nursing a stubbed toe after stumbling over Germaine in the darkness on the landing. "Somebody's going to burn the place down lighting candles to see where they're going. Glass can't be that expensive."
"Window tax," Roger informed her, picking Germaine up and dangling him head down over the banister to Germaine's intense delight.
"What?
The Crown taxes windows?"
"It does. You'd think people would care more about that than stamps or tea, but apparently they're used to the window tax."
"No wonder they're about to have a revel." "Oh, good morning, Mrs. Burns. The breakfast smells wonderful." The girls, the children, and I spent several days in careful shopping, while Roger and Jamie mixed business with pleasure in assorted tap rooms and taverns. Most of their errands were completed, and Jamie produced a small but useful subsidiary income from card playing and betting on horses. But all that he was able to hear of Stephen Bonnet was that he hadn't been seen in Wilmington for some months. I was privately relieved to hear this. It rained later in the week, hard enough to keep everyone indoors for 2 days. More than simple rain, it was a substantial storm with winds high enough to bend the palmetto trees half over and plaster the muddy streets with torn leaves and fallen branches. Massali sat up late into the night, listening to the wind, alternating between saying the rosary and playing cards with Jamie for distraction.
"Fergus did say it was a large ship he would be coming on from New Bern. The Octopus? That sounds good size, doesn't it, Da?"
"Oh, aye. Though I believe the packet boats are very safe, too." "No, dinna discard that, lass. Throw away the tray of spades instead."
"How do you know I have the tray of spades?"
she demanded, frowning suspiciously at him.
"And it's no true about the packet boats. You ken that as well as I do. We saw the wreckage of one at the bottom of Elm Street day before yesterday."
"I know you've got the tray of spades because I haven't," Jamie told her, tucking his hand of cards neatly against his chest. "And all the other spades have already turned up on the table. Besides, Fergus might come overland from New Bern. He may not be on a boat at all."
A gust of wind struck the house, rattling the shutters.
"Another reason not to have windows," Roger observed, looking over Masali's shoulder at her hand. "No, he's right. Discard the tray of spades."
"Here, you do it. I've got to go and see to Joni."
She rose suddenly, and thrusting the cards into Roger's hand, rustled off to the small room next door that she shared with her children. I hadn't heard Joni cry. There was a loud thump and scrape overhead as a detached tree limb sailed across the roof. Everyone looked up. Below the high-pitched keen of the wind, we could hear the hollow rumble of the surf boiling across the submerged mudflats, pounding on the shore.
"They that go down to the sea in ships," Roger quoted softly, "that do business in great waters, these see the works of the Lord and his wonders in the deep. For he commandeth and raiseth the stormy wind which lifteth up the waves thereof."
"Oh, you're a big help," Brianna said crossly. Already edgy, her temper had not been improved by the enforced seclusion. Jemmy, terrified by all the racket, had been wrapped around her like a poultice for the better part of 2 days. Both of them were hot, damp, and exceedingly cranky. Roger appeared not to be put off by her mood. He smiled, and bending down, peeled Jemmy away from her with some difficulty. He put the little boy on the floor, holding him by the hands.
"They reel to and fro," he said theatrically, pulling Jem's hand so that he lurched off balance, "and stagger like a drunken man, and are at their wits' end."
Jemmy was giggling, and even Brianna was beginning to smile, reluctantly.
"Then they cry unto the Lord in their trouble, and he bringeth them out of their distresses."
On bringeth, He swung Jemmy suddenly up in the air, caught him under the arms, and whirled him round, making him shriek in delight.
"He maketh the storm a calm, so that the waves thereof are still. Then are they glad because they be quiet."
He pulled Jemmy in.